from KXJZ in Sacramento. This is Inside. I'm Jeffrey Callison. Later in the program, a Nobel Peace Prize winner in Sacramento. First, folk and world musicians are gathering in the Sierra foothills this weekend for the American River Music Festival. It starts tomorrow morning. Two of the top attractions are guitarists Dan Crary and Beppe Gambetta. Dan Crary is an innovator of the flat-picking style of guitar. He lives in Placerville. Beppe Gambetta plays a variety of styles and lives in his native Italy. We'll meet him a little later, but first, here's Dan Crary. Dan, welcome to Inside.
Thanks. Glad to be here, Jeffrey.
What is flat picking, and how is it different from other guitar playing styles?
Yeah, that's it's a difficult thing to explain because many of the expressions for guitars are sort of, for example, the steel string guitar means a flat-topped, round-holed wooden guitar with steel strings, but then there are steel strings on electric guitars, and they don't call them steel string guitars. They call them electric guitars, and there's no real reason for it. But flat picking came out of country music and the invention of the large-bodied sort of dreadnought, sort of pear-shaped guitar in the 1930s by the C.F. Martin Company. And it was intended to be a rhythm instrument for what was called the kerosene circuit. The kerosene circuit, where you played in little halls and churches and town halls where there was no electrification, and you needed a loud guitar. But then, inevitably, musicians don't do what they're supposed to do, so some guys started playing lead on this instrument, and they did it with a plectrum or a flat pick. And they didn't want to call it plectrum music. They didn't think that sounded manly enough or something, a little too. So they called it flat picking, just to give it a name. But it refers to the development of lead playing on the steel string guitar back in the 40s.
Was that the kind of music you grew up with?
Yes, on the radio, however. And there was very little of this music right around me. No bluegrass, no lead picking on the steel string guitar at all. But I heard a little bit on the radio here and there. And it was enough to get me fired up and want to do that.
So the music these musicians were playing in the 30s was what? What would we call it today?
Well, probably old-timey music. Yeah. And they would have called it country music in those days. Or actually, that's a question I might not have a complete answer to, because being back there, people talked about themselves a little differently than we talk today. But most people would say that was old-time country music or folk music.
My guest is Dan Crary, guitarist, one of the innovators of flat-picking style.
It's hard to say, isn't it?
Yes,
we couldn't have had a cool name like jazz or something that was one syllable and classy sounding.
Very good. Well, thanks for bailing me out there. Dan is playing with Beppe Gambetta at the American River Music Festival tomorrow evening and Sunday afternoon. Now, flat picking as opposed to finger picking.
That's right. That would be different.
Did you ever do finger picking?
But behind closed doors, between consenting adults only, so as not to offend, I was never very good as a finger picker. And there are so many fabulous, incredible, unbelievable finger. It's a finger picker's world in many ways. And there are so many of my colleagues that are so good at that, I had better stick with what I can do, perhaps.
Why would someone choose to do flat picking as opposed to finger picking, or finger picking as opposed to flat picking? What kinds of music favor each?
Almost any kind of country or folk music can utilize the two different styles. The guitar comes out sounding different. The finger picking has a kind of sustain and a kind of rolling mini notes all in a kind of a pattern kind of effect. Flat picking, the rationale of flat picking is that you can play a melody note a lot cleaner and faster and harder than perhaps a finger picker would be able to do. But I think the real rationale for the flat pick is that it's a very powerful instrument to drive the dynamics out of these large-bodied guitars. So they play, you can dig very deeply for the sort of profundity that lies in the instrument with a flat pick.
What makes for a great flat-picking guitar player? Is it someone who can really play the chords in a rhythmic style, or is it someone who's better at, is it more about playing the leads and the licks?
Well, there are different players that are famous for both. For example, Charlie Waller of the Country Gentleman was famous pretty much only as a rhythm player, but he was an absolutely killer, beautiful rhythm player that drove one of the famous bands of the 60s and 70s. Somebody like Tony Rice is also a great rhythm player, but he's famous for the wonderful licks and moves and solo lines that he plays on the guitar. So there's room for all kinds. And in truth, what makes for a great player is someone who gets in touch with the force and finds some music to play that audiences want to listen to. And beyond that, it's kind of difficult to define, because there are some inspirational and charismatic players who aren't very technically strong players.
And when you say the force, what do you mean?
I was trying to leave that as vague as possible. it's ironic of me to talk about the force, but I do believe in a world spirit. Some people call this world spirit God. If you're in Star Wars, they call it the force. And I don't know what it is, but in music, I do think that there is something undefinable about the arts, actually. And it's one of the reasons why they're difficult to sell to school boards who are allocating short amounts of money. But on the other hand, it's one of the things that makes the arts awesome, because you can't define it. And once you do define it, that isn't it. The force has moved elsewhere when you really nail it down.
Yeah. Could you play a song for us?
Sure.
What is this?
If you don't mind my promoting my film, we just got the first shipment of our new film on the history of the guitar called Primal Twang. And it's going to be available soon. We're now marketing it. And this is the theme music from Primal Twang.
And Doc Watson's in that, isn't he?
He is.
And he's coming to the Mandavi Center pretty soon.
Yeah, Doc Watson, Albert Lee, I may forget some people, John Doan, the harp guitar player, the great classical player, help me out. I should have had these names in mind. Eric Johnson, the Grammy winner, is there, and lots of great players. Mason Williams.
Quite a lineup.
Yeah, quite a lineup. And this is a tune called In Flagrante. It's the theme for our film.
Thank you.
That's great. Thank you so much. Dan Crary, the great flat-picking guitarist. By the way, our resourceful senior producer, Jen Picard, says the classical guitarist on Primal Twang is Andrew York.
Andrew York. I actually thought of his name as I was playing. Andrew, my apologies. Well, you came back to me in a moment. I had a bit of a brain fladorange there.
One thing that occurred to me watching you play the guitar is that with most instruments, there's direct contact between the musician and the instrument, but with the flat picking, you've got this pick, you've got this little intermediary device.
Right.
Is it ever a challenge to stop the pick from getting in its own way when you're playing all these strings in rapid succession?
Well, yes, and the limitations of the pick are phenomenal. Every you know, every way of playing the guitar has its limitations. In 1923, when Andre Segovia did his debut in New York, the New York Times reviewer said, well, he was received very well, but I doubt that he will ever be able to overcome the limitations of the guitar.
Oh, goodness.
Well, Segovia proved him wrong, I think. But the way he overcame the limitations was he played to them. Every instrument can do things that other instruments can't do, and the flat pick has the problem of being only in one place at a time. A finger picker can... there's a joke about this. We say that we've been in therapy for not being able to play as many notes as the finger pickers, and it's called plectrum envy in the psychoanalytic literature. That's just a very bad joke, but it does represent a problem. The flat pick can be used to do a strum, but playing melody and accompaniment at the same time is quite a challenge to get it to move around. So that's a long way of answering your question with a yes. It does get in the way sometimes.
You're listening to Inside from KXJZ. Coming up, more conversation and music with Dan Crary. We'll also meet guitarist Beppe Gambetta, who's in concert with Dan this weekend at the American River Music Festival. We'll be right back. You're listening to Insight from KXJZ. I'm Jeffrey Callison. It's the American River Music Festival this weekend. Two of the top acts are guitarists Dan Crary and Beppe Gambetta. They're playing two sets together this weekend, tomorrow evening and Sunday afternoon. We already met Dan Crary. He stays with us in the studio. Joining us now is Beppe Gambetta. Beppe, welcome to Insight.
Buongiorno. Ciao.
Buongiorno. When you started the guitar, which was in Italy, which is where you're from, mm-hmm. What kind of music were you playing?
Actually, I played the classical music when I was a kid. I came from a family where there was a big passion for classical, as in many Italian families it happens. Mm. And so I started in an orchestra of children, playing some guitar, and after, of course, Led Zeppelin, because when I became a teenager, I switched over to some electric, and finally someone brought to my hometown this album with music of Doc Watson, the king of flat picking, and I heard Doc Watson, Tony Rice, Norman Blake, and Dan Crary, all of my heroes, and I decided to become a flat picker. Yes.
So when you started with classical guitar, of course, no pick and no steel strings.
Actually, I was playing with pick also because it was a plectrum orchestra, you know, the children plectrum orchestra with mandolins and some guitars. And we were playing already with plectrum, yes. But it was unusual, yes.
What was it about the flat picking guitar music that you heard that resonated with you? Why did that strike you so strongly?
The possibility to create an enormous amount of captivating rhythm, fantastic rhythmic solutions that Doc Watson had, but also the great possibility to be also poetic. You know, in some traditional music, you would think that is just a lot of rhythm, but in reality, there is a lyricism. There is acoustic music can be a lot poetic, and so when I heard some Clarence White, when I heard some parts from Tony Rice, I felt that that there was a great lyricism in it, and this called me strongly.
Was this music popular with other people in Italy?
No, it was a sort of a little niche, how you call it.
Well, a niche, yeah.
Yeah, niche. It is interesting. Even if you are alone, if a style, if a guitar style calls you, you spend your entire life to determine to understand how it has to be performed. So I spend hours and hours in front of my record player. And I transcribed the whole history of flat picking to understand what all the flat pickers they were doing.
My goodness.
Not the whole, but a lot of music, you know. Mm. And for some point of view, it was the same process that maybe Dan did by listening to the radio. You know, he was listening when he was young, the radio, and some heroes playing the guitar. And I was just listening to my stereo.
Well, probably easier for Dan to listen to the music on the radio in the U.S. than it was for you in Italy.
Yes, it's true, because you being not part of this culture, no, I didn't speak English, you know, and so it was really not an easy, it was a strong, difficult task, but... I even wrote a whole book of the history of flat picking in Italy, and I never was traveling through United States. I was just guessing a lot of things. But now, when I reread my first book that I wrote, they were right. That's pretty cool.
What did your family and friends think about you learning this American guitar music when you were young?
They thought that I was crazy, and no, actually there was this difficulty in Italy to propose this music that was sort of distant, because many people said, yes, you play this music, we have so much folk music here, and you look for the folk of another country, of another culture. And the same when I started to come in this country, when I was sort of a copy of Doc Watson, and say, yeah, what, we don't need really any Italian playing Black Mountain Rag. So actually the step, next step that I did of being allowing myself to be a little different and to bring in my music some of my roots was the winning step. So and that was the best way to do.
My guest is Beppe Gambetta, the guitarist. He's playing with my other guest, Dan Creary, at the American River Music Festival tomorrow evening and Sunday afternoon. It's in Lotus on the South Fork of the American River. Beppe, you have your guitar too, and you're going to play a song for us. What are you going to play?
Yes, I would like to play some old European traditional Ave Maria. Is a melody that comes from my latest project, and I actually got this request from a friend to play at his wedding, and I say, okay, maybe I play at the party after the wedding, and say, no, you are scheduled to perform in the church in the most spiritual moment, and I say, but do you know that I'm a flat picker? and he say, yes, I know, but I'm sure you will come up with some spiritual flat picking. So I worked hard on this old melody, Italian melody, that is an Ave Maria, traditional Ave Maria from Sardinia, and I thought I need to come up with some tremolo. And I thought that could be also my future, you know, older that you go, better the tremolo goes. So
yes.
Old Ave Maria is called, the title of it is Deus ti salvet Maria.
Very nice, thank you. Thank you. Very nice, Beppe Gambetta. Was your friend pleased with it?
Yes, yes, absolutely. The marriage is still on.
Good, I'm glad to hear it. Now, listening to that and watching it, more to the point, it sounds so much like something that a classical guitarist would play with his or her fingers, because you're playing it with a pick.
Yes.
Would it be easier to pick with your fingers?
I don't know. It's as Dan told, you know, with flat picking has some disadvantages because you have just one source of playing, and so you overcome this disadvantage by inventing new technique and new. And so I didn't really try what it would have been, but this sort of kind of sound is a new thing that I had to invent to overcome this. And this is the good thing of music, you know. If you think about the mouth, the harp that doesn't have every note, and all they invent a lot of variation just because the instrument is imperfect. And so I think from the imperfection of some techniques, sometimes some artistical beauty comes. And that's how I see it.
Without doubt, Beppe Gambetta and Dan Crary are playing together this weekend, and they often play together. They're at the American River Music Festival tomorrow evening and Sunday afternoon. Dan, tell us how you and Beppe got playing together.
A few years ago, somewhere in the 90s, Beppe came to the United States with the first DAT machine that anyone ever saw, digital audio tape, and traveled around the United States seeking out all the flat pickers he could find to do duets with. And that produced an album called
Dialogues.
Dialogues. And we got to be pretty good pals talking to each other and agreed that we would do a tour. And the only time I could do that, because I was a professor at Cal State Fullerton at the time, before my retirement there. And so we went in January on a European swing to various kinds of folk clubs and places that had small concert venues and so on. And lo and behold, it worked. We were actually able to book a tour, and so we just kept doing it. We never quite get it right, and we thought we should keep doing it till we get it right, and we never do, so we keep doing it.
But you're both flat pickers, but you seem to have definitely your own styles. How do you figure out what you're going to do together musically that will work together?
In a sense, I think it's better that we have different styles because they don't climb on top of each other. Mm-hmm. There's nothing worse than seven or eight guitarists all in the same room playing the same thing as you have in some jam sessions. And so
I use, for example, open tunings. And Dan doesn't use them. And this complement the two guitars really well. So
sometimes we play in different positions than each other. And so it works out. But one does have to scheme in order to make it work.
Well, you're going to play a duet for us.
Yes.
And I think we're going to have to move a little microphones around here first. So if you do that, get yourself set up, and I'll let the audience know, remind our audience who we're listening to, Beppe Gambetta and Dan Crary, the two flat-picking guitarists. They're two of the top performers at the American River Music Festival, which starts tomorrow and runs through Sunday evening in Lotus. And Beppe and Dan have two sets tomorrow evening and Sunday afternoon. And the setting up here, retuning guitars. What song are we going to be hearing? You have to say this loudly.
We're going to do an old traditional song. We think it's traditional. It's credited to the Monroe Brothers from the 1930s, called Long Journey Home.
Great.
Yes, it's about trains, you know, and a good thing of the guitar is that the guitar can make the sound of the train.
when I'm on my long journey home. Feeling kind of blue, sick and lonesome, and I'm feeling kind of blue, and I'm on my long journey home. Got to go home, boys, got to go home. Cold and it's raining and I got to go home, and I'm on my long journey home. Surely is a train, boy, surely is a train. Like smoke's arising, and it surely is a train, and I'm on my long journey home.
That was great. Thank you so much, gentlemen. We have 2 minutes. Could you just scoot back to the speaking microphones, okay, please? Yes. Dan Crary and Beppe Gambetta, they're playing two sets at the American River Music Festival this weekend. Dan, there's a lot of musicians, a lot of people playing the jam sessions and so on. What's it like as a musician to go to an event like this?
Well, this appears to be a very well-organized festival, and I know the guy that's organizing it, Matt, is working hard to make this a superb event, and I'm sure it's going to be. And there are opportunities for camping, and those produce jam sessions at this kind of event. And it's wonderful. Stand around a fire, feel like it's 50,000 years ago. And look
for some gold.
That's right. And you could look for some gold up there in the gold country. But playing music around a fire at night is a beautiful thing. And the setting accounts for a lot, too, and it's a beautiful setting. And it's also beautiful for one other reason, and that is it is not an airplane ride away from my home. It's just 10 miles down the road, which is just wonderful.
A bit further from Italy, of course.
A little far away from Genova, Italy, but it is a joyful thing to participate at the festival. It's really beautiful to meet music enthusiasts and to be in that kind of environment. But the music of the other artists that you are exposed is also fantastic because there will be Laurie Lewis and so many other great musicians. So it's going to be fantastic.
Well, I'm sure it's great, and I wish you both the best this weekend, and I thank you both very much for coming down to our studio today.
We're happy to be here. Thank you for giving some attention to our music.
Thank you so much. Yes.
Dan Crary and Beppe Gambetta playing at the American River Music Festival tomorrow evening and Sunday afternoon. There are many other artists. Go to our webpage, capradio.org/insight, for a link to more information. Thanks, gentlemen. You're listening to Insight from KXJZ. Coming up, a Nobel Peace Prize winner is in Sacramento today. You'll meet Wangari Maathai when we return. You're listening to Insight from KXJZ. I'm Jeffrey Callison. You can listen to Insight live online. To stream our show, go to capradio.org/insight. A Nobel Peace Prize winner is in Sacramento today. She's Wangari Maathai of Kenya. Her profession is veterinary anatomy. She's also a member of the Kenyan Parliament. But Wangari Maathai is best known internationally as an environmental activist who led the reforesting of her country. She was awarded the Nobel Peace Prize in 2004. Wangari Maathai has a busy day today in Sacramento, ending with a talk tonight at the Westminster Presbyterian Church. This afternoon, she's in our studio. Wangari Maathai, welcome to Insight.
Thank you so much.
You wrote the story of your life in a book called Unbowed, and it starts with your childhood in a village in the rural part of your country. And we have a reading I'm going to ask you to read from your book. This is from your childhood.
This is from childhood.
I guess it was an important part of your life.
It's a very important part of my life. And I describe it because I wanted to capture how beautiful and how green and exciting the countryside was, and also how I started changing my life in a way by having my family make decisions that actually made it possible for me to be here today. And I'm very grateful they did it. So let me read that part. I moved, for those of you who may have read the book, I have been to Nakuru area, and now we are going back to where my parents originally came from. So soon after we arrived in Nyeri, my brother Delito posed a question to my mother. How come Wangari doesn't go to school like the rest of us? Delito was about 13 at the time and had just started high school. It was not a wholly shocking question. There was a precedent in my family for educating girls. My uncle Kamunya was sending all his children, including our daughter, to school, but it was still not a common practice. My mother thought for a moment and then replied, "There's no reason why not." Although I do not know what happened next, I suspect my mother consulted my uncle, who would have acted as my father's representative as the head of the homestead. He must have agreed, because it was decided that indeed I should join my cousin at Ihithe Primary School. Nonetheless, this was a big decision for my mother. My sister Monica had joined us, so my mother had three children younger than me to look after. There was also school fees to consider. Even though they were only 1 shilling and 50 cents per term, that was a lot of money for a rural family then. My mother could easily have said, "We don't have enough money, and I need her at home." What is the point of a girl going to school? Yet, although she had almost no formal education herself, she agreed with my brother. How grateful I am that she made the decision she did, because I could not have made it for myself, and it changed my life. I've often wondered what would have happened if Delito had not asked my mother his question, and if she had not answered as she did. To this day, I do not know where the money for my education came from. But my mother probably raised it by working for people in the village, cultivating their land. At that time, you could earn up to 60 cents a day doing such work.
Thank you very much, Wangari Maathai, reading from her memoir, Unbowed. As you grew up, you became a political person, served in parliament. You met a lot of opposition from powerful people and forces in the country. What brought you into politics, into political work?
It was almost an accident that I ended up in politics, really, because as you read the book, you realize that after that early experience in my village, I ended up in Atchison, Kansas, in the 60s. And it was partly due to an initiative that was introduced by Senator John Kennedy, who later on became the President of the United States. And then I went back home, and all I wanted was to become a lecturer at the University of Nairobi, which I joined in 1966. And it was while I was there that I started experiencing injustices that are meted against women at that time, where I was being treated not as a full lecturer, yet I was fully qualified and I was doing a very good job and I was working very hard, but I was getting less than my male colleagues. And that perplexed me. And especially having been to America, where I had tasted the freedom and the desire to achieve and the desire to experience full potential, I started agitating so that women in the University of Nairobi would have the same terms of service as men. And that was the beginning of my questioning inequities, questioning corruption, questioning the unwillingness of society to treat everybody as equal. And that eventually is what led me into politics, because it all has to do with the political decisions.
What kind of opposition did you meet when you decided to be an active politician?
Initially, it was not understood as activism that would threaten the authorities. I think that it was not until I started organizing women to plant trees that the authorities realized that what I was doing was potentially dangerous to them, because I was organizing, I was mobilizing, and I was also educating, empowering people and encouraging them to question when there are injustices, when human rights are not respected, when the rule of law is not respected, when people are corrupt, when people misuse the power that they have. That's when they considered me a threat.
What gave you the idea, the specific idea, to start planting trees?
The idea comes from the fact that in the mid-1970s, in precisely 1975, there was going to be the very first United Nations Conference on Women, and it was going to be in Mexico. And women all over the world were encouraged to discuss the issues that they would raise in Mexico. And so in Kenya, we did that under the auspices of the National Council of Women of Kenya. And while I went there to take my problems from the university, such as the discrimination of women in the university, when I went there, I started listening to the women from the rural areas. And I realized that some of these women came from the same areas where I grew up, and which I described in the book, and which is very beautiful. And it was quite clear that something drastic had taken place in that area, and the environment had become degraded. The women were saying they needed clean drinking water. Yet I remember as a child going to the river and drinking water from the river and bringing water to the household and drinking without even thinking of boiling it. They also wanted firewood. And I remember there being a lot of woodlots and me collecting firewood from these woodlots. And they needed food, nutritious food. Well, I remember that we had a lot of food. So by listening to these rural women, and perhaps because I had an education in biology, I was very quickly able to make the link between the problems that the women were describing and made them, and I understood that these problems were actually symptoms of an environment that has become degraded. And so I told the women, let us plant trees. I never went to Mexico myself, but I immediately started what I thought would be a short-term project to plant trees with these women.
My guest is Wangari Maathai. She's speaking tonight in Sacramento at the Westminster Presbyterian in a special California Lectures event. She wrote Unbowed, a memoir of her life and work as an environmental leader in her homeland of Kenya. She won the 2004 Nobel Peace Prize in large part because of her work with the Green Belt Movement, which she founded. It's a network of women who've planted 40 million trees across the country. Have those 40 million trees replaced what was lost?
Well, you know, we need to plant many more millions of trees. Because, unfortunately, a large portion of the people we are working with are poor people, they are rural people, and their main source of energy is wood. And so even as they are planting, they are also using these trees for some felt needs, such as the need for firewood, for fencing, for building their houses, for fodder for their animals. And so the competition for wood is still very high. But the important thing is to be able to explain to the women and to the society in general that trees are extremely important in our environment and that we need to plant them faster than we are cutting them. So although we have been able to change some landscapes in a very drastic way, we still need a lot of trees to be planted so that we can truly say that the country is fully green.
In your memoir, Unbowed, there's one section where you talk about the meaning of your first name. Could you tell us what it means?
Now, my name, Wangari, sounds very close to the name of the leopard, because the leopard is called in my language, Gari. So if you say Wangari, it means that of the leopard. And so when I was little, and I find this very interesting because remember I said that there were lots of woodlots. We lived very close to the forest. So it was very easy for us to encounter wildlife. Wildlife was plenty during my childhood. And so to encounter a leopard or to encounter an antelope was common. And somehow I think it was a way of making us children not be afraid of these animals. So my mother told me that if I should ever find a leopard by the roadside, and apparently when this, it was made to understand that when they sit by the roadside, they put their tails across the walking path. So I was told, if you ever find a leopard with its tail across the walking path, don't step on the tail. Instead, talk to it and tell it, you too belong to Wangari. And since it is a Gari and you are Wangari, you have nothing to fight about. And the amazing thing is, first of all, I never in my whole life encountered a leopard with a tail across the path.
Good.
But I never feared leopards since then. I always felt like I could talk to them and I could appease them and that the two of us would never have anything to fight about.
Finally, Wangari, I was told that when you go to events, certainly today in Sacramento, there are a lot of people coming up to you, coming up close to you, almost like you're a rock star. What is it? Do you know?
Well, I think that people have been fascinated by the message that the Norwegian Nobel Committee gave to the world in the year 2004, when the committee decided that the time had come for the prize to recognize the environment. That our awareness about the environment that actually goes back many years, many of us may not remember, but the very first environment conference was in Stockholm in 1972. So some 35 years ago, the world met in Stockholm, and that was the first time that the world focused on the environment. Well, I think we have understood very well the environment, and we have come to realize that it is very central to our life. But the Norwegian Nobel Committee wanted us to understand that the environment is more than just something to sustain us, that we must take care of it so that we can also enjoy peace. Because if we don't take care of the environment, if we don't manage the resources properly, we can create situations that bring about conflict. And so that linkage with peace and democracy was extremely important. And I think that's what fascinates people.
Well, we're out of time. I want to thank you so much for joining us today, Wangari Maathai.
Thank you.
Thanks so much for, I know it's a busy day in Sacramento. Wangari Maathai speaking tonight at Westminster Presbyterian. And that's Insight for today. I'm Jeffrey Callis. And for more information about the guests and topics you hear on Insight, go to our webpage, capradio.org/insight. Insight's theme was composed by Joe Gilman and Paul Conley. Our technical director is Mark Jones. Our senior producer, Jen Picard. Insight's executive producer is Carl Watanabe. And thank you for joining us.